And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Dave P. from San Diego. Welcome, Dave.
How you doing, guys? I'm Dave. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dave.
Great to be sober. Alcoholic. I've been thinking about myself all day. Again, thank you, Jim and Debbie, for coming and hanging out with me and having dinner. They're kind of my cheering section. So I said I'm alcoholic. I'm probably way more alcoholic than anyone else in this room. Not just because I'm up here, but because I'm that self-centered. So I'll do a little kind of drunkalogue for you guys and tell you some really strange and tragic shit that we can all laugh about. And then I'm going to jump right into some solution. On the way over here, I was thinking you really need to talk about solution because, 2017 can suck it. If you had a good year, good for you. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink. I planned a few murders, and I did a lot of inventory, and I made amends. And so here we go. I got in trouble when I was about 8. And I'm not saying that because it's cool. It lost cool a long time ago. I got in trouble when I was about 8 years old for drinking. And I thought it would be cool to put tequila in some kind of little bottle and triple sec. I don't even know what the hell that is. But I put some of that in another little bottle, and I brought it to a roller rink. It was a friend's birthday party. I was a little kid. I was born in Minnesota, and they had this birthday party in the wintertime at this roller rink. And I got caught with it, and I was banned for life from that roller rink. Now, like Tyler was saying, you'd think that would be enough, right? I mean, we had a meeting in my parents' living room. All the other parents, because the kids that knew me, they all got in trouble too because they knew me. That happened a lot. So there was a big powwow in my parents' living room, and my mother was the one that said, "Do any of you think there's a problem here?" I raised my hand, mostly because I thought I would get in less trouble if I raised my hand. But I raised my hand, and as far as I know, I'm the only one that got kicked out of that roller rink that's in Alcoholics Anonymous today. I'm probably the only one that also ended up homeless and suicidal and alone due to drinking. So there's not a lot of social occasions for an 8-year-old to drink booze. So I would create them. And I did that as often as I could. I was always sneaking booze. We moved out to California when I was like 12. I found something else that was a lot easier to get that kind of did the trick, and I did a lot of that, but always, always drinking. By 17, I was locked up in a mental institution. I did not get to go onto the drug and alcohol rehabilitation side. I was on the other side where you couldn't have your own scissors, and I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. They had a little, like a meeting down in the cafeteria downstairs. I'm going to drink your water, Tyler. And I don't remember anything that was said at that meeting. I know that there were people who did not have on slippers. No wonder I don't drink water. So there was all these like regular people that came into this hospital, this lockdown ward, and had an AA meeting. And I stuck as many sugar cubes as I could in my pocket because I knew if I went up to my room and ate a bunch of sugar, I would feel different. And I did. And right before, there was like a psychiatrist assigned to me when I was in there. I didn't like him. And we had a little one-on-one right before I got out of there. And he said, what's up, man? He said, you know, I don't think you're an alcoholic right now. But if you have one more drink, you will be. What an idiot, right? So I thought about that. And I figured there's really only one way to prove that idiot wrong. So I started drinking again, and I got into more trouble. And this time when I got into trouble, I got arrested, and I had to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous with a piece of paper. Sometimes they're called attendance slips or court cards. A really good friend of mine calls them gift certificates. So I came in and I got signatures, and the heat kind of died down a little bit, and it took me, I don't know, 31 days, something like that, and I was back at it again. So that was my kind of my pattern, is I would drink and get in trouble and then come into AA for punishment. That's kind of what I thought this was when I was younger. So when I would come into Alcoholics Anonymous, there were people that would offer me help here. They would offer to sponsor me, and they would offer to take me through the steps, and they would offer to read some book with me. And what happens to me, I'm still batshit crazy. Yep. But I start to feel a little physically better once I'm separated from alcohol, and I like to do a lot of accelerants too. That I use that to treat my alcoholism a lot. So I don't sleep and I don't eat and I'm drinking all the time and I'm dehydrated. So when I come into AA, I like drink fluids and I eat a little bit of solid food and I sleep and I don't feel so like horrible, you know, physically horrible anymore. And then I'm like. You know, that step stuff is kind of cool for you guys, because you're obviously, like, really bad. But I'm already kind of feeling a little bit better. So I'm going to hang out, and I think I'm good. Really. You can just kind of leave me alone now. And so, like, I did that several times, and I managed to stay sober on, like, coffee and going to Heidi's and going to meetings and just being around sober people for 3 years. Still batshit crazy. what I didn't know, and I know it was said, my ear holes were too tight then, or I wasn't convinced. But what I didn't realize is that I'm totally powerless over alcohol when I'm sober. And I thought, yeah, okay, like when I'm drinking, it's bad. And I know when I'm drinking, I drink too much, and I always overshoot the mark. And I know I've been gone for 2 weeks, and I really don't have a story even where I was, and I'm sorry, and the money's gone. But I didn't realize that I was powerless. I always take the first drink sober. First drink is always coming with Dave's sober mind. So over and over again, I did the same thing. The last time I was out, I fell off a roof. I was sober, but I fell off a roof, and I hurt my knee, and the doctor gave me some Vicodin. Pills are too slow. I don't do pills. And I honestly never took a handful of those Vicodin to get high. I wanted to be unconscious. So I'm taking a bunch of Vicodin, and I'm also eating like a whole bunch of Tylenol PM all at the same time, because I'm really in a lot of pain, and I want to be unconscious. unbeknownst to me, the Vicodin was kind of was working its magic with my alcoholism, which was untreated. And a buddy of mine came over. It was football season. He came over and he brought a couple of tall boys for him, and he brought me a six-pack of Diet Pepsi. And it was fine the first time. The next week he came over, and he had a couple of tall boys and a six-pack of Diet Pepsi, and he only got one tall boy. And I was off on, hopefully, I know God's willing, hopefully I'm willing, the run to end all runs for me. And I had gotten in August of 2002, I had gotten like $36,000 from when I fell off that roof. And I thought, oh, I'm set, right? By Christmas, I had been living in the apartment with no electricity for a couple of months. I had two cars repossessed. I was being evicted. I had gone big, and I had gone and bought a bunch of Christmas gifts for people, right, because I had all this cash. And I had already returned those. And I had also pawned or traded or clucked or whatever, everything that you could plug in or was worth $5. I had given it all away so I could stay loaded. And somehow this offer was made to my wife Dan and I that we were going to go out to Arizona and dry out. We were going to stay at this house that was owned by a church, and I don't know what the hell I was going to do out there, but that's where we were going to go. And we had this little U-Haul that had like this ratty old bed and some clothes in the back of it, and there was two cats stuffed underneath the seat, and we were going to drive to Arizona. And I lived in El Cajon on the corner of Cuyamaca and Fletcher Parkway, right by Parkway Bowl right there. So the sheriffs came. They actually do come. I didn't think they'd actually show up, but they came at like 12:01. And they escorted me out of that apartment by my neck, and I was not allowed to be back on property. So I'd been drinking all day and probably doing some other stuff, and they said I'm not allowed back on property. So I kind of like came to a little bit, and we got in that U-Haul, and we were going to head to Arizona. I made it all the way to the corner of 70th and Alvarado. Which, for any of you not familiar with San Diego freeways, that's west, and I wanted to go east. And something happened on that corner, and like my whole world broke. I shattered on the inside, and all of that stuff inside that I had been drinking and killing, trying to kill and stuffing down, and just trying to keep drunk or quiet, all of that stuff, I couldn't do it anymore. I'm going to backtrack just a second. The Christmas, right, that was in like February when that happened. The Christmas before that, someone had given me something to return to a Home Depot, and I knew I wasn't going to get cash. It was always a gift card thing because there's no receipt. So she dropped me off at the Home Depot, and it was raining really hard. And I went into the Home Depot, and I returned the stupid thing, and I got the stupid gift card. And I walked outside, and she was gone. She split, right? So it's only a couple blocks to my house, but I was really counting on that ride in my car to get back home. So I walked. This is when the Home Depot was in the other spot right there on like Marshall, I think. So I walked to the corner of Fletcher Parkway and Marshall, and it's dark and it's raining really hard, and I'm standing there and I'm soaking wet and I am radiating hate, right? Like I'm in a rage. And this truck, pickup truck, I keep thinking he's going to be at a meeting. This pickup truck comes down the hill, and you can do about 50 miles an hour down that hill. And this guy leans out of the window, and he goes, "Don't you think you should go to a meeting?" So in the dark, pouring down rain at 50 miles an hour, that guy could see that I needed a meeting. He's not here, is he? One of these days, I'm going to get him. I'd have killed him that night. I'd just shake his hand now. He was absolutely right. So a couple of months go by, and like the wheels are falling off. And on that corner on 70th and Alvarado, my world came crashing down, and I had nothing left. And I started walking, and she got behind the wheel of that U-Haul, and she took off. And I walked up the hill to this little trailer where my sister and her boyfriend were living and tweaking. And I remembered this guy's phone number from Alcoholics Anonymous. It was still the same from like 1995, and this is 2003. Still the same number. He was one of those guys, you know, I don't know if you guys have been in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, but you haven't been in a meeting for like 3 years, 4 years. And you come into the same meeting, and that same guy is in the same seat still. God, that used to bug me. I mean, it drove me. Like, he never leaves? What is the, like, he doesn't have anything to do? I was really, really grateful when I came back this time, and there was the same guys in the same meetings in the same seats. Suddenly, for whatever reason, that gave me hope. And I believe that the reason that gave me hope is because I was beaten. I was absolutely beaten by alcohol, and I knew it. I truly, truly knew that I was alcoholic. There had been, since 8, there had been people telling me they had a drinking problem. And there was handcuffs, and there was jail, and there was gavels, and there were probation officers, and there were fingers wagging in my face, and tears, a lot of tears, and especially the tears. In the book, it talks about frothy emotional appeal. It also talks about how we're unable to differentiate the true from the false. And I need to tell you something, standing here right now, when I broke their hearts again, and I saw the pain on their face, and how I had disappointed them again, I would swear off. And I meant it. With everything that I am, I meant it, that I was going to not do that to you again. And I'd end up drunk. And it was so baffling for so long how I could mean it and put so much willpower into it and like really try really hard to not drink again and end up loaded again and do the same thing over and over again. So when I got up to that little trailer and they were tweaking tight little circles, I made that phone call, and that guy, he answered his phone, and he offered me not to sponsor me this time. He didn't offer to take me through the steps. He didn't. Really, what he offered me is his phone and his couch, because I needed somewhere to detox, and I needed to start making phone calls to try and get in someplace, because I didn't have anywhere to live. And that kind of started this whole process. I just did what he said, and I called people. I got on waiting lists, and I went down. I tried to get into detox, and it had been like 2 days since I had a drink, and the guy who was doing like the intake or whatever, the volunteer guy down at detox, that was when it was on Island Street. He goes, we really can't take you into detox, but because you already are, but I can recommend you for the 10-day pre-treatment program. And I go, you know, that's not really going to work for me. If I leave and the cops bring me back and I'm drunk, can I get in? Well, no, I appreciate your willingness. I was really, really desperate, and I was really afraid. And for a long time, right up till that day, my only conscious contact, my kind of relationship with God, was I was begging him to kill me every day, begging him for this one to be enough to blow my heart out, begging him for this one to be enough to, like, make me pass out and choke on my own puke, something. I couldn't do it anymore, but I couldn't take myself out either. So that changed, I guess. I didn't know it changed. And I started kind of trying to do this prayer, and I started, like I said, taking some suggestions, and I got into that 10-day deal, and I got, from there, I went up to a place in Campo, and I was kind of spoon-fed the big book for 108 days, and I had this plan that I was going to, I was really a mess, I had this plan that I was going to make a lot of money up there by weed whacking and digging chicken shit out of these trenches, because when I was new there, that's what other guys were doing. They were going on these little pay jobs, and I had volunteered for kitchen staff. I was almost at the end of my time there before I realized that when you're on kitchen staff, they don't send you on pay jobs because you're working three times a day at the Freedom Ranch. So, like, I had a month left or whatever, and I'm like, oh, crap. Okay, I quit the kitchen. Now I want to go on pay jobs, and I only went on, like, three. So when it was almost my time to leave, I had, like, $6. And thank God. I truly thank God that I had about $6 because I had a plan. I had done a third step up there, and I had actually written an inventory up there, but I was also making a plan. And my plan was I was going to have enough money to come down here and save her and get a place, and everything was going to be okay again. And that didn't work, and I was able to go down and fill out an application for another place down in Golden Hills. And I got to stay there, and that's where I met my sponsor. And I did another inventory with him. And I found out a lot of stuff about myself that I had no intention of knowing, honestly. Like, I knew I was dishonest, sort of. I knew I was selfish sometimes. I knew I was thirsty a lot. You know, that was kind of the extent of it. So I'm doing this inventory, and I had thought that for a long time I was resentful at my grandfather, because when I was seven, remember I got in trouble for drinking when I was eight, when I was seven, my grandfather killed himself. And he was my hero. He was this great big guy that had this really loud laugh, and he used to play the harmonica, which is nowhere near as sexy as it used to be a long time ago. And I used to follow him around the house as a little kid. Now, this is not going to be real macho or anything, but there was a seven-year-old little kid running around behind his grandfather, and I'd follow him into the kitchen, and he had those, they're like aluminum, those like 12-ounce cups or whatever they are. They don't really have them anymore. But he drank out of one of those, and he would go to the refrigerator, and he would fill it with vodka, and he would down it. And then he would fill it again, and he would go sit down. And I remember this like it was yesterday. When he would down it, I'd be standing behind him, and he would go like this. And then he would fill it again, and he would go sit down. I get that. That's like relief. You know what I mean? My friend Jim does this heavy sigh, like, oh, all right, I can exist. I can be in reasonable proximity to other human beings and tolerate them. And so when I'm doing this fifth step, no one ever sat me down and told me that I was useless, or that I was unlovable, or that I was a piece of shit. I told myself that story right after he killed himself. And the seven-year-old kid took on this burden of, if I would have been a better little boy, he wouldn't have had to do that. That's heavy. I'm almost 47. That's heavy for me right now. That's heavy. So what I did with that little nugget is I spent my whole life going around looking for evidence that I was useless and that I was unlovable and that I was a piece of shit. And I found it everywhere I went because I created it, but I found it everywhere I went. And to be sitting across from another man and to realize that truth and to realize that story for the lie that it was, I'm not going to tell you that sometimes I don't still feel like that. But it ruled my life. Every day. Always. It always ruled my life until I did that inventory. A lot of other stuff that I found out that my eighth step is going to be a lot longer than my fourth step. So after I did my fifth step, and I was able to, I had a lot of information, and it was a lot of it was really, really uncomfortable. It didn't sit well, that's who I was, and that's who I had been for so long. And I was still in launch mode, though. Like, I still have to, there's still action that needs to be taken. So I went and I did that little paragraph in the big book. It says to take an hour and go over what we've done. And I'm not going to quote it verbatim because I'll screw it up and someone will get offended. But it wants us to kind of go over what we've done so far. And I did that, and there was nothing that I left out. In fact, when I started the inventory, there was two things that I didn't want on paper. It's silly now because those are the things that I use to help a newcomer. But those two things that I didn't want on paper, those are the two things I told him first. There wasn't really any resentment with it. It wasn't really fear. It was just some chicken shit stuff that I did when I was a kid. So I told him that first, and then the rest of it was just kind of easy for me. I made the 8 step list, and I started making amends right away. And it says wherever possible, just so you know. Wherever possible, not whenever possible. So after I'd been sober for a minute and I had a little job, wherever came up. And all the people that I owed money to, they knew where I was and they knew how to get a hold of me, and I was given an opportunity to make amends that I didn't think I was ready for. I got to pay back all that dead money. I got to take a trip to Florida, and I got to make amends to my dad, who I abused him, not physically, but I just like leached off of him for years and took advantage of him. And when I made amends to him, we were standing in his backyard, and I'd been praying about it, and I walked up to him and I said, I really need to talk to you. And he goes, I thought so. He doesn't know anything about this. But he goes, I thought so. And so I made the amends to him, and I had it. I didn't read it off, but I had written it on a piece of paper, and I'd gone over it with my sponsor, and I knew what I needed to say. Because I have a tendency to, when it's like gnarly stuff like that, like I'm emotional, right? I don't want the amends to, I don't want to cloud it and make him feel bad because I'm emotional. So I had a plan that I went over with my sponsor, so I knew what to do and I knew what to say, and I knew exactly what I was going to do. And he said, son, your slate is clean. And I wasn't expecting that, really. I kind of wanted him to, like, jump in my ass a little bit. But we've been good ever since then. And when I talk to him now, he doesn't live in San Diego, but when I talk to him now, I don't hit him up for money. No one in my family is worried about where I am tonight. I get the privilege today of, Kip was talking about it, I get the privilege today of being a closed mouth friend and taking men through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never thought that I would be, I was really curious all those other times I was in AA when I wasn't doing nothing. How come nobody ever, they never asked me to sponsor them? What's going on? Like, I know some shit. How come nobody wants what I got? I didn't want what I had either. But I was willing to give it away. So, like, it's still, like, a huge deal when I get to help someone else in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, I don't, you know, I don't do this perfectly. I've had an interest, I kind of let off with that. I've had an interesting year. I'll theoretically have 15 years sober this coming February. And you don't have to clap for that. That's okay. But I'm still a mess. I had a heart attack last December, and those suck. And and really, I'll tell you guys the truth. I'm self-destructive when I'm sober. I do some self-destructive eating, and I was smoking like crazy. And I remember I would put two frozen pizzas into the oven at the same time and go, bring it on, heart attack. And it did. It did. So I don't say that anymore, and I also don't eat two frozen pizzas at the same time anymore. And then a few months ago, I got hurt, and so, like, my future looks different than I thought it was going to. I didn't think it was going to look like this when I was almost 15 years sober and 47 years old. And my life is not shiny. Sorry. I don't have a great big house, and I don't have toys, and I don't drive the truck I want. I don't have the boat I want. I don't have a boat at all, actually. I got no boat. But I didn't come here for that. What I came here for was that I was dying of alcoholism, and I needed help. And you guys have given me that help, and you have given me... I didn't want my old life back. One of my friends gets really offended when he says that I'm living a life beyond my wildest dreams. Because I have some pretty wild dreams, but even though I don't have shiny stuff, like, I've never been content. I've never been okay alone. I don't like to be around anybody, but it kind of sucks. I don't want to be around nobody, but I hate being alone. I never said that out loud before. That's the truth. But, like, I have been okay alone, and I have been content. And I got a crew of guys that I run with, and we go to meetings, and we don't co-sign no bullshit. And not only my sponsor knows all of my stuff, but the guys that I sponsor know all of my stuff, and my friends know all of my stuff. So when I'm kind of like going off the rails a little bit, someone will say something very rude and inappropriate to me to pull me back over. Right? So what's really happened to me is I took the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous when I got here with that sponsor. We talked a little bit about the inventory, and what happened, I was able through that inventory to clear away and recognize enough of what wasn't true and what was, like, I didn't think God wanted anything to do with me because I was unlovable, because I was useless, because I was a piece of shit. I was all that stuff. God wanted nothing to do with me. And I was like educated as a young child about religious things. So I knew I was screwed, right? I didn't have a chance. Excuse me. What happened when I took the steps is enough of that stuff was, that made enough room in me for God to get in there. And all of the religious information that I was given, all of those things that I knew I could never live up to, that stuff kind of fell away too, and I was able to develop a relationship with God that it's not the same as it was when I got sober. He's bigger than I'll ever need him to be. I still have a hard time trusting him with some stuff, though. He's got the drinking thing. I'm 100% convinced of that. Relationships and finances. I'd like a little more. I'd like him to pay a little more attention. Maybe snap it up a little bit and give me a clue. Give me a sign. Give me something. Don't give me a sign. I learned don't give me a sign when I said the heart attack thing, and I got one. So I'm gonna close with this. I'll be forever grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. You guys have carried me when I couldn't do it myself. And the greatest honor that I have is that I get to do it. I get to be there for other men and help them through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and watch them. Like, the steps really affected my life, but watching another man, how they affect him, and then how he helps someone else, you know what I mean? That, oh, man, that is such good stuff. And I hope everyone had a sober Christmas. If you did not, I hope it sucked. I hope the sheriffs are coming. I hope the car is gone. I hope the money is all gone. I hope the booze is gone. I wish you pain. A friend of mine says that, and he said he's like really like kind of intense. So when he says it, it's like way more meaningful. But I do like I couldn't become desperate and willing to do this until I had pain, and until alcohol brought me to my knees. And when I was there and I needed help, you guys helped me. Thanks.